Lecture 15, What We Say, the Expanding English Vocabulary.
Hello, and welcome to the expanding world of the English vocabulary. In addition to sound changes, English in the Renaissance, in the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries, was changing dramatically in incorporating new words. The voracity, the omnivorousness of the English language shows itself perhaps most clearly in this period. As new words enter, as new words are coined, and as the shape and texture of the vocabulary as a whole changes irrevocably. An early dictionary of English published at the beginning of the 17th century called itself a new world of words. And that, in many ways, is the subject of this lecture, Lecture 15 in the series. The new world of words in English is a vocabulary drawn from learning, from science and philosophy, but also from contact with new cultures, new societies, and different speakers. Some of the languages were European. Some of them were not. It is an age of economic and colonial expansion, of scientific exploration, and of intellectual inquiry. These new words came to be classified in various ways. And perhaps the most interesting group of words to look at in the Renaissance is a group known as inkhorn terms. These, of course, are words coined from Latin or Greek, but they're inkhorn terms because they come right out of the inkhorn or right out of the inkwell. They are learned words. They're the mark of education by the user, but they're sometimes the mark of derision by those who did not really feel that inkhorn words spoke to the birth tongue or the well of English or the genius of the language. Inkhorn terms have an allure, an exoticism. Indeed, a word like allurement is itself an inkhorn term coined in the 16th century. Allusion, anachronism, autograph, capsule, denunciation, dexterity, emanation, excursion, halo, jurisprudence, abject, appropriate, conspicuous, dexterous, expensive, insane, malignant, adapt, alienate, assassinate, benefit, erupt, harass, meditate. A whole string of inkhorn terms, a spill of words out of the inkwell. You can hear in these words what made them characteristic. They are polysyllabic. They have many syllables. They are often based on Latin or Greek. And they refer specifically to heightened concepts, to specific features of new disciplines or new landscapes. Milton is a great coiner and user of the inkhorn. Disregard, for example, is first used by Milton. Milton, in fact, uses and coins many words. A good one is at that moment, it seems to me, when Satan and his crew are arguing in pandemonium. Milton describes it as a hubbub. A hubbub is a Miltonic word. If ever you want to describe a political debate and use the word hubbub, you're going back to Milton. You're going back to the moment of pandemonium. Milton gives us pandemonium because it is the place of all the demons. You remember from an earlier lecture on Indo-European. Pan, five, but pan, all. Pandemonium, all the demons. Pandemonium now is not the demons, but the sounds the demons made. Something that is pandemonium is something that is wild and crazy. Now, when inkhorn terms entered poetry, they came to be known as aureate terms. Aureate really just means golden. And these words were thought of as golden for a variety of reasons. They seemed to shine in their Latinate or Greekate beauty. They were elaborate words, a diction of such rarefied nature that they seemed jewels of language. But they were also aureate terms because the poets who used them believed that they were creating a language that was as hard and immutable as the noble metal gold. Aureate diction is a phenomenon in the history of English literature that runs from the mid-15th up until the end of the 16th century, a phenomenon in which writers strive to develop a beautiful and an elaborate language. Aureate diction, however, had its detractors as well as its proponents. The sound of aureation is strange and beautiful, yet the sound of aureation to some ears could seem almost manic. In the mid-16th century, the scholar and grammarian Thomas Wilson wrote a handbook for poets called The Art of Poetry. It was first published in the year 1553. Thomas Wilson liked to parody the aureate style. And here's a little version of it that I'll read to you. It's just a sentence long. And it's as wild and onomatopoetic and evocative as anything I've read from middle or early modern English. He says, "I cannot but celebrate and extol your magnifical dexterity above all other. For how could you have adapted such illustrate prerogative and dominical superiority if the fecundity of your ingenii had not been so fertile and wonderful pregnant?" Now, this sounds like double talk to us, and I'd be prepared to bet it sounded like double talk in the mid-16th century. It's double talky nature. I can't even translate it. I think basically all it just says is, "You're wonderful." Its double-talky nature lies in the heightened use of an elevated vocabulary, a language of aureation, a language of the inkhorn. Words like magnifical, dexterity, prerogative. Words like dexterity and prerogative are back in the language. They're still there. A word like fecundity. Yes, that's there. But a word like ingenii, from the Latin ingenium, meaning a feature of mind, what we would now call a genius quality, is not a word we continue to use. Many inkhorn terms, in fact, don't survive. To read the language of the 16th century is to read words like adepted, which means attained, adnichilate, which means to reduce to nothing, adnichilate, to nihil, invigilate, to be watchful. Actually, that word may be coming back now. Obstupefact. It's even hard for me to say. Obstupefact. To make unclear. To demit. To send away. This is on the model of comit or transmit. Mittere, Latin, to send. Comit, to send with. Transmit, to send across. Demit, to send away. Eximius, which means excellent. I think I'd like to make a case for the return of eximius to the language. And one of my favorites, temulent, which means drunk. Now, the new world of words came into English not just from these Latin and Greek coinages, but also from colonial and economic expansion. Commerce and contact with European countries brought new words into English. For example, from France in the 16th century, words like alloy, meaning a mixture of metals, bigot, meaning an intolerant person, bombast, meaning a great sound or noise, a duel, a fight between two, entrance, equip, essay, explore. It is, in fact, Montaigne who gives us the word essay in his essays that create the genre in the 16th century. Essays explore. Of course, the French also gave us words for other things. Mustache comes in the 16th century. Progress, talisman, tomato, and volunteer. From Italy, we get words for architecture and exploration. Argosy, which is itself a coinage on the Greek. The Argo, the journey of the Argonauts. An argosy, modeled on the Odyssey, the journey of Odysseus. Balcony, Where but could Romeo and Juliet find their desire but on a balcony? A word directly borrowed from Italian. Granite, as great stone cutters, the Italians would have bequeathed to English the vocabulary of their craft. Stanza, as great poets, the Italians would have given to the English the words for the new organizing principles of poetry. Violin. How can you not say the word violin and not think of Cremona, not think of Stradivarius or Amati or Guarneri and volcano? Where but in Italy is the veritable volcano of Western culture but Pompeii? Spain and Portugal give words of maritime and military connotation. Anchovy. Armada. The defeat of the Spanish Armada gives us Armada. Banana. Where were the bananas found but through Spanish and Portuguese colonial expansion? Cannibal. What did you find when you looked for bananas? You looked for people who were so strange, so alien, to invoke once again that key term of the history of the language. People so alien that you imagined them eaters of men, cannibals. Cocoa, discovered by the Spanish and the Portuguese. Embargo, maize, mulatto, potato, tobacco, yam. These words enter English through colonial and economic expansion, through Spanish and Portuguese traders, through colonists, through explorers and conquerors. From the Dutch, smuggler, cruise, jib, reef, walrus, blunderbuss, tattoo, and knapsack. Notice that these are words not just from different languages, but words from different registers, and in particular, the register or tone of colonialization and military engagement. So many of our technical terms for naval military activity, so many of our terms for food, so many of our terms for the architecture of world expansion are terms borrowed from the French, Italian, Spanish, Portuguese, and Dutch. And yet, words too came from non-European languages. From Arabic, we get sash, hashish, mohair, sherbet, sofa, and henna. Words that in their collocation seem to speak of the European imagination of a sybaritic Middle East, a world of potentates who sat eating sherbet on mohair sofas, smoking hashish in their henna-dyed sashes. In Turkish, you'd see the word dolmen, a word coffee, which the Turks do introduce into England and Europe. Kaftan and kiosk. The Chinese gives us ketchup, a word for a kind of fermented sauce or paste that eventually comes to be associated with tomatoes. And of course, in Africa, we get zebra. The North American languages bequeathed to English certain words on first contact between colonist and colonized, conqueror and conquered. Raccoon, moose, skunk, hickory, totem, canoe. The European imagination was being fueled by contact with new nations and in turn by contact with the resources of those nations. And so, through science and naturalism, new words also entered. Discovery of the human body was like discovery of new places. Vertebrae, for example, is a word that enters English with the discovery, the opening up, as it were, of the human body. Torpor, specimen, spectrum, mica, lens. I'm speaking now almost at random. Mathematics, words from Greek and Latin, chord, cylinder, prism, and calculus. And from philosophy, dogma, critic, curriculum, crux, propaganda, and alibi. Now, the growth of the English language prompted not just a welcome of these new worlds of words, but some debate and some dissent as well. What were the wellsprings of English? In the 16th and the 17th centuries, scholars, critics, and pedagogues confronted this new world of words by asking questions about just what remained of English itself. Was English, at its heart, a Germanic language to which French and Latin and others had been added, or was English now irrevocably changed? Had it lost its roots, its origins, its nature, or its genius? Such questions also are part of a larger turn in the history of English education towards an understanding of what came to be called the excellence of English. In other words, the study of language became a way of doing cultural politics by other means. English schoolmasters of the 16th and 17th centuries frequently reflected on the nature of English. I'll be talking about some of them in future lectures. In this, I'd like to pause over one of them, Alexander Gill. Alexander Gill was one of the most fascinating figures in the history of English education. He lived from 1564 until 1635. He was the headmaster of St. Paul's School. He was Milton's teacher. And in 1619, he published a book called Logonomia Anglica, Words of English, or English Study of Words. Now, Gill did many things. He advocated a reform in spelling. He argued that words should represent the pronunciation of the educated. But also, his views on language were couched in some of the most extreme and metaphorical ways. As I've said before, one of the themes of this course is really the way in which we talk about language, the metaphors or images we use to explain language change and language variation. Are they organic? Are they architectural? Are they topographical? Let's look at Alexander Gill in 1619, writing in the Logonomia Anglica. He says, and I'm going to read this passage, about the year 1400, Geoffrey Chaucer, star of ill omen, rendered his poetry notorious by the use of Latin or French words. Let me just stop here. I've read you, Chaucer. It's beautiful. It's exquisite. I've argued that its use of Latin and French words is pressed into the service of an articulated poetic vision that corresponds to a new sense of vernacular literature in the late 14th century. For Alexander Gill, it's simply notorious. And he goes on. Such is the stupidity of the uneducated masses that they admire most what they least comprehend. From that time on, a new scurry appeared in writing and speaking. For since everyone wishes to appear as a smatterer of tongues and to vaunt his proficiency in Latin, French, or any other language, so daily wild beasts of words are tamed and horrid, evil-sounding magpies and owls of unpropitious birth are taught to hazard our words. Thus today we are, for the most part, Englishmen not speaking English and not understood by English ears, nor are we satisfied with having begotten this illegitimate progeny, nourished this monster, but we have also exiled that which was legitimate, our birthright, pleasant in expression and acknowledged by our forefathers. O cruel country! Alexander Gill, 1619. And yet a text which resonates both backwards to Trevisa and forwards, as we'll see, to many commentators on the English language today. Let me look at this in some detail. Let me show you not just the extreme quality of Gill, but his subtlety and his manipulation. Gill first begins by arguing that what's wrong with English is literature. I've talked about how the language of politics, chancery English, the language of learning, could influence the tone and texture, the spelling and the idiom of poetry. Now Gill is in effect saying that the problem with that poetry is that it bequeaths to English something which is non-English, something alien. The story of the alien, again, is central to the narrative of English language. Such is the stupidity of the uneducated masses. This is Milton's teacher. I mean, what man could teach Milton? Head of St. Paul's School. And he's talking about the stupidity of the uneducated masses. They admire most what they least comprehend. There is in that statement something of a kind of Ciceronian maxim. It just feels like a classical Latin idiom. It sounds like an aphorism because it's the sound of the schoolmaster speaking here. From that time on, he says, a scurry appeared. I mean, listen to the word, a scurry, as if now writers were rats scurrying across the floor of English. A smatterer of tongues. This is, in its own way, as evocative as the harrying, gaddying, and grizz-beating of John of Trevisa. That smatterer of tongues. Wild beasts of words are tamed. Now, it's not a new world of words, but wild beasts. The English language is a crazy zoo. What you encounter in the landscapes of colonial worlds, what you encounter in those inner landscapes of science and philosophy and literature are now not beauties, but beasts. Horrid, evil-sounding magpies. Horrid. The word horrid comes from the Latin, and it means bristling. Milton will use the word horrid precisely in that way to mean spiky and bristling in some way. It's a word that Virgil loved. Horrid, evil-sounding magpies are bristling. It's a word like scurry or smatter that is designed to evoke the physical. Magpies and owls of unpropitious birth. Now we're going back to Trevisa and the birth tongue. And what's the problem with birth? The problem with birth is your progeny legitimate or is it illegitimate? This is something central to the 16th and the 17th centuries. Not just because of dynastic problems, not just because of problems of inheritance, but because, and I believe this strongly, in the contact with colonial worlds, in the contact with non-European peoples, there is the pervasive fear of illegitimacy, of miscegenation. What Gill is imagining is an English that is so apeired, so diluted, so changed, in Trevisa's words, an English that is so changed and challenged by contact with other cultures and other languages that it is no longer legitimate. It is, in short, a bastard English, a monster now, a horrid sport given birth. But we have also exiled that which was legitimate. The story that Gill tells in 1619 is now the story of another fall. I mentioned in an earlier lecture the way in which the story of language throughout history is the story of images and metaphors, and in particular in Christian theology, the story of a fall from Eden, or a fall from linguistic unity in Babel. Now, what Gill imagines is another kind of fall. The man who taught Milton, the man who taught the man who wrote Paradise Lost, tells a story of lost paradise. This new world of words is not an Eden, but a hell. And its creatures are not beauties, but they are monsters. I think we must read this passage, and many others like it, with this wild, almost pre-Miltonic feel to it. The story here is a story of exile and alienation, a story of language as the fall. Now, when we look at language changing, and when we see here and in subsequent lectures how English is altered, transmuted, or transformed by borrowing words or by coinages, we need also to understand what's happening to the words themselves. And in wrapping up this lecture, I want to introduce a term which will play an important role in some of my subsequent lectures, especially on Shakespeare's English at the close of the 16th century. And that term is polysemy. Polysemy means many meanings. A word is polysemous if it carries several meanings or connotations with it. As words entered the language, words already in the language were also affected. The 16th and 17th centuries are not just periods of new words coming in, they're periods of words changing their meaning. Polysemy affects, for example, the commercial vocabulary. It affects the religious vocabulary. A word like silly, which I'd mentioned in an earlier lecture, is a good example of polysemy. The word begins in Old English to refer to someone who is blessed, touched by the Lord. And gradually, its meaning changes to reflect not the inner quality of blessedness, but the outer performance of being touched or being spiritual. In this period, silly is a polysemous word. It is a word that connotes both the newer sense of silliness of behavior, but also the older sense of being blessed. It can be used in different ways. Words from the commercial vocabulary, words like cheap, that are constantly shifting in meaning from simple purchase to something which is inexpensive, to something which is of poor quality, let's say. Or words that we will see in later lectures constantly changing meaning and form. Polysemy also operates in a very important way when we look at figurative meaning in words. We'll see in later lectures how dictionary makers confronted the legacy of this new world of words and of polysemy by trying to define words in special ways. And one problem of definition is whether you take the literal or the metaphorical meaning. Take words like flagrant or ardent. These are words which for us now have figurative meaning, yet they are words which once had very specific concrete meaning. In particular, flagrant means on fire, and ardent means burning. Should we give primacy to the older literal meaning, or should we give primacy to the newer figurative meaning, even when that old meaning is lost? This question, which is a question for dictionary makers, is a question for writers and speakers of the period. The question of the literal and the metaphorical is a problem for lexicographers. It is a problem for schoolmasters, and it is a problem for writers and critics. For when we look at the language of Shakespeare, when we look at the language of literary writers in the Renaissance and later in American English, what we'll be seeing are precisely these problems of adjudication between the literal and the metaphorical. If, as I suggested, Chaucer is making a synthesis of new words from different languages, Shakespeare, as we will soon see, is splitting up those words, creating a kind of linguistic fission, and showing us the workings of word history and etymology in single terms. From Chaucer to Shakespeare, the new world of words is something both strange and wonderful, alien and familiar, horrid and monstrous on the other on the one hand, but seductive, beautiful, and admirable on the other. The golden age is yet to come. Thank you.